For several years, I have taken in the study class here in the HPB Lodge the subject of the esoteric tradition throughout the ages, and that included this period of the beginnings of the Christian Church. Since then, the last couple of months, I've done a lot of more reading on the subject, got more and more bamboozled, got led into a lot of little other interests in the subject, because it's a very wide subject, but have all the same, I think, got a better view of the whole thing. Now, when one gets past the orthodox view of Christianity and its beginnings, one finds a mass of contradiction, mistranslation, and some things which appear to be misinformation. That is, that they're slanted. That's knowledge or teaching or ideas are slanted in the direction away from the actual truth. So we find ourselves in a sort of a quagmire. Now, above that quagmire, there are a few lumps that are solid. And you can stand on those lumps and say, yes, I know this is right, but the rest of it, there are many, many question marks. Now, in this book, which has recently come out, Messianic Legacy, by Bajan, Lee, and Lincoln, who wrote The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail as well, and did a tremendous amount of research. Now, the research that they have done is objective, like me, because I haven't had a great deal of association with the Christian Church and the Bible, and I have tried to approach it without any preconceived ideas in an objective way. Well, the writers of this book make the statements, although there is today real scholarship in biblical investigation among what they call the establishment, these findings seldom reach the general public. From the Pope down, the Pope and the Cardinals and many other leaders in the Protestant Church have a very deep understanding of the beginnings of Christianity, but it has not filtered through to the general public. Possibly it's because it wasn't intended to. The Dead Sea Scrolls, a few books have been written on those, but there has been tremendous difficulties encountered by historians in getting the original Dead Sea Scrolls, and being able to work on them. Dr. Stephen Holler, when he was here, left a little pamphlet telling how there was, first of all, a Frenchman in charge of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and now there's an American. But in both cases, they're not giving out the information they should be. And many of the Dead Sea Scrolls have gone into the Vatican and stay there. And many of them have gone into the museum in Jerusalem, the Hebrew Museum, and stayed there. So there is still, in the world today, a great deal of bigotry, blind faith, and prejudices about the beginnings of the Christian Church. And there is arising fundamentalism, which literally accepts as true every word in the Bible. As far as theosophical studies go, H.P. Blavatsky, Annie Besant in Esoteric Christianity, and Geoffrey Hodgson in his Hidden Wisdom in the Holy Bible have looked upon the Bible as an allegorical story of initiation and the growth of the spiritual nature in man. Christos, to them, is Atma Buddhimanus, the spiritual individuality or the ego of man. There is, of course, tremendous truth in this. If you can get into the real translation, the real inner meaning of the Bible, there is the whole of the esoteric tradition there, but it's not so easy to get at. But it's a story as well. And I traveled, this years ago now, but I traveled through the Holy Land, and I must admit that the places mentioned in the Bible are there as they are described in the Bible. So you get there a difficulty in reconciling whether it's a story, a place, an actual story, or whether it's entirely symbolic. Both, of course. Now I'm going to try and pinpoint also, briefly, it'll only be at the end, in this confusing story, where the distortion and how the distortion has occurred. How the original teachings, magnificent teachings, which we as theosophists could accept, have been distorted and obliterated. Now here is what I would consider, from a theosophical point of view, the original teachings. We have to accept one supreme deity. In the Bible it's called Father in Heaven. The central cause, the creative cause in which we live and move and have our being. And secondly, man as a threefold being. Spirit, spiritual nature, Atma Buddhi Manas if you like, the soul of the personality and the physical body. And in that spirit, that in that physical body, in our consciousness, and especially at the higher level, but right through all of us, plays that divine spark, as HPB called it, which is of the same essential nature as the Godhead or the Supreme Deity. And thirdly, the spiritual life has its own, as its aim, the release of the spiritual nature from its imprisonment in the personality, or, if you like, the inflow into the personality of Christ consciousness, so that we become self-realized beings. That's the third. And fourth would be the recognition of the cycles of reincarnation and the law of karma, which governs the law of cause and effect. Now, that's the beginning. Now, we'll now go back to a story which will test the truth and how it has been distorted, how it's been ignored and accepted only by the few. Joseph of Arimathea is recognized by students of the Bible as being the uncle, or possibly the great uncle, of Jesus. Now, it is established that he was a well-educated merchant in Jerusalem who had tin mines in Cornwall. And he many times took his ships to Cornwall and exported the tin to Phoenicia, which of course is Lebanon, sold it there. But in Jerusalem, he was an influential person, an official. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, the ruling body of the Orthodox Jews. And because of that, he was able to protect the disciples. Now, after the crucifixion, the disciples spread wide. They moved out of Jerusalem. They couldn't stay there. So it is said that Joseph of Arimathea, in AD 36, 3 years perhaps, or 5 years or 6 years after the crucifixion, went to by ship to Marseille in the south of France. Now, there is a lot of evidence for this. A lot of the data taken is from a book called The Drama of the Lost Disciples by a man called Jowett. It's the British Israel basis. And it took me years. I used to think they were funny people. They used to have a shop across the road here. But actually, a lot of what they say has got basis in fact, as you will see as I go on. Now, one of the best references to this is by a Cardinal Baronius, who was curator of the Vatican Library, and wrote that he and others, that's Joseph of Arimathea and others, were set afloat in a boat without oars or sail. Now, that might be allegorical. But anyway, he would be in a position to get help from others. And I have no doubt that he could have been, he was able to get to Marseille. He had with him Lazarus and the Mary Magdalene. At Marseille, Joseph was consecrated as a bishop by St. Philip, the disciple, who had already set up the Christian church in the south of France, which expanded upward. So leaving Lazarus and Magdalene behind in Gaul, that's in France, he went to Glastonbury in Britain, where he established the first Christian church, probably in the world. There may have been one in Gaul. It was a wattle and daub building, and it lasted through the centuries. It was built probably about 39 AD, 3 years after they landed. I understand that there was a chapel built over it in Glastonbury, and it was there until about 1100 AD. And the records of all this were in Glastonbury and were recorded by people like Geoffrey of Monmouth and so on. The tradition is there. And the British royal families of the time, I'll talk about them later, were converted to Christianity. But remember, there was no Bible at this time. The Bible came 300 years later. This was what I'm going to call Nazarene Christianity. It was the original Christianity of Jesus and the Nazarene group. Joseph of Arimathea was one of Jesus' inner group of disciples who knew the esoteric teaching. And I'm going to suggest as I go on that this esoteric teaching was the same as the Essenes. And it was the same as the teachings of the Druids. The Druids, according to Yarka in his book, Yarkane Schools, actually were in contact, part of their activity, part of their rituals, part of their religion, came from as far back as Egypt, from Assyria or the Chaldeans, and also they have in their ritual, he said, some of the teachings of the ancient mysteries of Samothrace in northern Greece. And of course the two flowed easily together, because the Essenes, that which the Essenes of the Dead Sea sect were made as their religion, had the esoteric tradition in it, which comes from Egypt, from Assyria, the Chaldeans, even from India, and it's all, and Greece, the mystery school. It's all there in their teachings. Now the name Chaldee, which you, there's a Chaldean society in Thames here. Chaldee means Chaldeans, and the Chaldees are the early Christians of Ireland and Wales. Remember there was a program on the TV a while ago about the Celts and how they came right across Europe. They came actually from Phoenicia and then from Persia. And as I said, they had all those traditions. The Celts moved right across Europe and they set up their church, which would be based on the church of of Joseph of Arimathea. That was the beginning. In fact, there are some historians who say that the Druids knew about Christianity even before Joseph of Arimathea got there. And there certainly was a great deal of contact between Israel or Palestine and the south of England. Now, I haven't got a pointer, but you see there's a little bit in Spain, Brittany, Cornwall, Wales, and Northumbria, as well as Ireland and Scotland. The Celtic Church was established there. Now that means that Lindisfarne, who some of you may have heard about, the monastery on the east coast of North England, and Iona, the Isle of Iona, those were not Christian churches in the true sense. They were Nazarene churches, the Celtic churches, with a Celtic tradition. Which perhaps it takes a bit of getting used to, but that basically is so. Back up their argument in the Messianic legacy, they show this, which is the Celtic cross, which you will all recognize, and its insight, you can see it better up there, this particular type of ornament, which is very similar to the Arabic ornament, was used also in the cross on the right-hand side at the bottom, which is from a Coptic, an Egyptian church, 12th century AD admittedly. But you see the tie-up. Now, the Nestorians came from Palestine, and some of them went across to the west, and some of them came to Egypt. And I'll come to this later. Anyway, there was the Coptic church, which was separate from the Roman Catholic Church, and which still exists. Now, the British royal families who were converted to Christianity were the Silurians. And they were the stock from which Queen Elizabeth or Henry VIII were chosen. And the greatest, I won't talk about it, but the greatest woman warrior in the world is admitted as Boadicea, who's a little later than my story, but she's the Britannia, and she was a magnificent woman. Unfortunately, she thought she had lost the battle and she committed suicide I think 80 or 90 AD. But the Britons were magnificent people. You hear about them in history as barbarians. That's what the Romans called them. And we go on calling, even in England, they call themselves barbarians, the early Britons, because the Romans called them that. They were well skilled in Latin and in Greek. They had universities and they had schools of teaching of Druidic, for the Druids. And there are heaps and heaps of records, Celtic records, documents in the British Museum and in the Vatican Library, that will attest to this. They taught the Romans enameling, and I think a lot to do with glass. That's where Glastonbury comes from. It was the glass factory. And Julius Caesar himself acknowledged that they believed the Britons believed in the immortality of the soul, which made them the fiercest fighters that the Romans had ever encountered. And Tacitus, the Roman historian, says exactly the same thing. And they kept entirely the Roman legions out of Wales and southwest England. Now, Emperor Claudius got so mad about not being able to conquer the Britons that he made an edict in 42 AD, exterminate Christian Britain. And he sent his best legions and his best commanders to do just that. Now you may have heard of Caractacus. I remember it when I went to school, but I had a very blurred idea of who he was or what he was. He was Caradoc, his British name. But he was Caractacus in the Latin form. And he was the Pendragon. He was the warrior priest. A tremendous person. He was finally beaten by the Romans in 52 AD at Qin or Chine. And that, do you know how he was beaten? There was treachery on the part of some of his own people. But the Romans had brought elephants across the English Channel in their ships. God only knows how they do it. And Caractacus and his British warriors were not afraid of the elephants. That didn't worry them. But what upset them was that the smell of the elephants upset the horses pulling the chariots, and they went haywire. They were beaten and they were taken back. The whole of Caractacus' family was taken back to Rome. They're usually called semi-prisoners. They were taken through the streets of Rome, and some say they had chains on them. I don't know. This is all a bit confused. But anyway, when Caractacus went before the Senate to plead his case, he took with him his daughter, who was called Gladys, a princess. And he made such a noble stand that the Roman Senate gave him liberty in Rome. This is almost unbelievable, because anybody who was a Christian, and they were avowed Christians, were thrown to the lions. And he became what we would call relatively free. And they set up in Rome the palace, the British palace in Rome. Now Gladys, who was adopted by the emperor Claudius, changed her name to Claudia. And she was able to mix with the society. And there was another one, Pomponia, another Briton, married a Roman, and it was the same thing. They rose right to the top in Roman society. And Claudia married a Roman general and senator, a general they'd been fighting against in England, in Britain, not so long ago. These things are unbelievable. This is absolutely true. And they set up the British Palace. Now that still exists today. It became the Christian church in Rome in about AD 58. The first bishop, call it Christian if you like, but it's Nazarene Christian, it's early Christian. First bishop in Rome was a Briton, Linus. And he was a son of Caractacus and a brother of Claudia. Now in his letters, St. Paul, letters to Timothy, St. Paul says that he stayed with the British. And he, I think, consecrated Bishop Linus. But he was a Briton. And the children of Claudia, whose daughter married a Roman senator. Now the daughter of the Roman senator and Claudia was Prudentiana. And in 1956, she befriended St. Paul and St. Peter in this church that I just showed you. 56, cut off the 19. Now it was in 66 AD that the children of Claudia, Prudentiana was the chief one, brought back the martyred body of St. Paul's and buried it in the crypt under that basilica of it's there called Prudentiana, but it's the same person. And he was buried under there, and I think St. Peter was too. And hundreds of the martyred Christians were collected, because you see, Prudens, the Roman senator, had become a Christian, and he sort of protected them, and all these martyrs were brought back and buried in the crypt of this church. Now, the beloved Prudentiana, immortalized in the Roman martyrologies. Evidently, there's a whole big book in existence, which gives the lives of all the martyrs, and very definitely she is in there. Now she was executed in 107 AD, and all the British line was completely exterminated in Rome by 140 AD. And remember, they martyred Peter, Saint Peter we'll call him. And then they made him head of the Christian church. I just can't, I don't know. So all the members of the British family were killed or interned. In the Via Ostensis, where that church still exists. Now there's a crypt under that church where there is a memorial to Prudence, St. Paul, and the martyred daughters. And I have got the book In the Steps of St. Paul by H.V. Morton, and I looked this up to see what he said about it. I was staggered again. If what I've been saying is true, it ought to be studied and recognized by people who write a book on St. Paul. And here's what Morton says. If it is true, we can indulge in the pleasing reflection that among the members of the Christian community in Rome who knew St. Paul and St. Peter were natives of England, not Britain, England. A grudging little acknowledgement. No understanding of what the actual position was. The British church, the Nazarene church from Jerusalem through Glastonbury, was brought to Rome, and that was the beginning. But at the same time, of course, St. Paul was preaching, and I'll come to that now. St. Paul the Gentile never met Jesus. He was Saul of Tarsus, and he was a vicious exterminator of the Christian people in Jerusalem. One of the books calls him, he had a Gestapo. Then he had a spiritual experience on the road to Damascus, which is very hard to understand. When I was working this out in my own mind, I found that this was very difficult to reconcile that the St. Paul, or as we hear and know him, and the Saul of Tarsus. And I read a book by Dr. Van der Leo, the theosophist called The Dramatic History of the Christian Faith. And he said he had the same problem to reconcile Saul of Tarsus with St. Paul. And I can't help wondering myself whether when he had that experience on the road to Damascus, somebody else took his body. Because in a way, that's where the Christian church, as we know it, started. The Nazarene church has not influenced, unfortunately in some ways, fortunately in others, the Western world to the same extent. Because he was a sinner turned saint. Now, others have done this. Milarepa, the Buddhist, did it. St. Francis of Assisi, I believe, did it. But somehow, to turn from an exterminator of the Jews to go and preach their gospel is something that's very hard to understand. Not only did he not meet Jesus, but when he did meet Jesus' brother, James, sometimes called Jacob, the Nazarenes, who were the group of the disciples around James, would not accept his teachings nor St. Paul. They called him the false prophet of the Gentiles, the Gentiles being the Romans. He was a Roman. But they helped him to escape over the wall, so he wasn't actually killed. And then there's a gap in his life. That must have been, I suppose, about 35 AD. From 35 AD to 45 AD, when he started working with St. Barnabas in Antioch, in Syria, a bit further north, there's a gap. And right through the secret doctrine, H.P. Blavatsky calls him an initiate into the mysteries. She doesn't go any further. I haven't read all of Isis Unveiled yet. And time. But she calls him an initiate. And certainly the teaching which he gives is the teaching that you would expect from an initiate. But his letters were written between 55 AD and 59 AD, and they're authentic, 13 of them exist, but they're based on hearsay. That's very remarkable. And they're based on his own inner experience. His writings are esoteric. He talks about the mysteries of God, the Christ within. He talks about one God, one Father. who is above all, through all, in all, and in you. You see, in the eyes of the church, but at the same time, he opened the door for Jesus to be labeled God incarnate and a personal savior, which of course the Romans later used. Now the Nazareans and the Gnostics who came later didn't look upon Jesus as God, but as a human being, a divinely inspired person, a teacher. And for centuries, the Nazareans who carried on and the Gnostics called Paul a false prophet. But he started the Western Church, and he's given us magnificent teaching. Now then, we go on to something new. All the existing copies of the Gospel, those ones that still exist, were written after 300 AD. Now, in those 200 years in between, the slaughter of the Christians in Rome went on, spasmodically, depending on who was emperor. But it went on. Now, these documents are codices, which means a copy of a copy. There are no originals. Except perhaps the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are originals and are pre-Christian. Now, I have seen somewhere, it may be in Leadbeater's Christian Creed, but I don't know when I read it, a whole list of those codices. The ones I remembered are the Codex Sinaiticus, which was found in a monastery in the middle of the Sinai Desert, probably about 500 years ago, and the Bruce Codex, which was found by an Englishman last century in Egypt. Now, most of these are in the Vatican Library and not easy to get at. It's very unlikely, I've got here that it wasn't, but it's very unlikely that any of them were written by the disciples. I'm talking about what they call the synoptic gospels, those gospels that can be compared. And that's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They weren't written by the disciples, because they weren't written in Aramaic. The manuscripts we have were written mostly in Greek. It is presumed that an original document, perhaps by Matthew, exists, or existed in those days, and that the writers of the synoptic gospels had access to it, or to that, yes, to those original gospels. Now, you've got to accept that one. They're all written after 300 AD, and they were not written, oh, I haven't got that here, they were not written by the original disciples. Now, this is out of a book, which I hope would have been on sale here. I did arrange for someone to be got. It's actually written by a man in Christchurch called Donald Offwood. He's a spiritualist, but it's called Reincarnation and Christianity. And it's a good little book, and we'll have to, because the Brick Road Publishing Company in Takapuna have it. Anyway, he publishes this, which is out of a book by Formation of the Gospels by Spivey and Smith, Anatomy of the New Testament. Now, the Gospels were written between 66 and 135 AD. Between two revolts against the Romans, the Jews were persecuted for 200 more years in a state of ferment all the time. And every time there was a revolt, as there was in 66, I think, AD, and another one over the 100, 125 or something, the books were burnt, destroyed. And the beautiful libraries in Alexandria were also being burnt periodically, and restocked and reburnt. So, yeah, you can see the mess we get into as far as original documents go. Now, the Gospel of Mark was written 66 to 67 AD by a man called John Mark, who had discourses with the disciple, I'll put a question mark there, Peter, who was martyred in 65 AD, and he was influenced by St. Paul and is mentioned in his epistles, his letters. So you see, he was really in the Pauline, the St. Paul tradition, the Western tradition, the Gentile tradition, not the Nazarene. St. Clements of Alexandria, who H.P. Blavatsky says was a genuine initiate, and I'll mention him later if I've got time, says that the Gospel of Mark was written in Rome for Romans and Greeks. Now, they could not present in these Gospels the Romans as the villains in the piece at the crucifixion, so they put the blame on the Jews. That's made very clear in this book. So we get a distortion because of that. They're protecting the Romans, whereas they were the villains, not the Jews. Sanhedrin, and some of the, I think it's Sadducees, I don't know how to pronounce these names, a lot of them cooperated with the Romans. And of course, they were the Orthodox Jews. But you classed them with the Romans. Now, the Gospel of Luke was written 80 AD, in Greece. Luke was a Greek doctor who traveled with Paul and collected sayings and doings of Jesus, some of which were not found elsewhere. A Greek doctor. The Gospel of Matthew was written 85 AD, in Greek also. The original disciple would have written in Aramaic. And he used Mark's gospel, but made alterations and embellishments. He included too strongly Jewish and anti-Paul material, and some of the investigators say he was trying to bridge the gap between the Nazareans and the Pauline followers. And he was the one that placed Peter as Peter the chief apostle and made him father of the church, the man the Romans had martyred in 66 AD. Now you'll see there's a Q there. The Q is a hypothetical source which Luke and Matthew share when the influence of Mark is withdrawn. Now the Gospel of John was written about 100 AD. The disciple would have been 90 years old at least then if he had written it. But it was written in Greece, and it had a sort of a religious aspect. Very deep, rather wonderful religious aspect, rather, and doesn't give history the way the other Gospels do. But it shows a good knowledge of Palestine. And again, you get your paradox, your difficulty. It has the most mystical way of looking at things. In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare one for you. You know that the translation of many masses is halting places, according to Annie Besant and esoteric Christianity, and so on. Now, there's evidence that there was a secret gospel of St. John. And I think fragments of those gospels were found among the Akamadi scrolls. The synoptic gospels were written at least 40 years after the crucifixion. 35 may be more accurate. And before that, the teaching was oral, as you saw on the previous diagram. And they were not written by the disciples. They are inconsistent and often contradictory. In the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, written by the same people, which made a great stir, they say this: the four Gospels not only contradict one another, but at times disagree violently. Matthew says Jesus was an aristocrat, descended via Solomon from King David. Luke says he was less exalted stock, perhaps from the line of David. And from his version comes the poor carpenter. An aristocrat and a poor carpenter. Luke presents him as meek and lamb-like. Matthew, powerful and majestic. The words on the cross are different. Matthew and Mark My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Luke, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. John, it is finished. I haven't checked up on all these. I'm taking their word for it. You check up. Now, the wrong translation of one word can make a big difference. One Greek word. In the Authorized Version, Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's there, I've seen it. By a band of men. But in the Catholic Bible, the Vulgate, the Greek word should be translated as he is arrested by a cohort, which is 500 soldiers at least. Was he a real rebel? Was he so dangerous? No. Now, it does seem that the original document, now lost, was rewritten by several followers, not disciples of Jesus, each expressing their story in their own individual way. And in the inner life, C.W. Leadbeater gives his version of this, which he saw by clairvoyant means. Certainly, I'm quoting C.W. Leadbeater, certainly the Christian Bible ought not to be taken literally, for many of its statements are symbolic and simply not true. For all four Gospels were founded on a shorter document written in Hebrew, Aramaic, by a monk called Matthias, who lived in the desert south of Palestine, Sinai. He seems to have conceived the idea of casting some of the great facts of initiation, the spiritual life, into a narrative form and mingling with it some points out of the life of the real Jesus, who was born 105 BC, and some of the life of another quite obscure fanatical preacher who was condemned to death and executed in Jerusalem about 30 AD, which is the date we have in the Bible. He sent this document to the chief abbot of a large monastery in Alexandria and suggested that he or his assistants issue it in Greek. Several monks produced their versions, each incorporating in his story more or less of the original manuscripts of Matthias, but adding legends as he happened to know or as his taste or fancy dictated. Four still survive: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now then, that CWL, you can take it, we can leave it, but it looks fairly reasonable when you think of the whole story. Now, those to whom he referred are, first of all, the three candidates. There are more. You can read many, many books about Jesus going to India and Japan and all sorts of places, but I'm not going into the whole thing today. But these are the best recognized ones. Joseph ben Pandira was born about 105 BC. Now, he's the only Christ or Jesus that the Jews will accept. When I read that, I was staggered. He's the Jesus of the Jews. His story is in the Jeshua Toldoth, which I think is similar to the Jewish Talmud, but it's got a different name. I spoke to Mr. Hodson about this, and he said yes, he'd seen what's called the Jeshua Talmud or the Jeshua Toldoth. And there are writers who have written about him, Bishop of Cyprus in the 4th century did, and others, as he was an historic character. The theosophist G.R.S. Mead has written a whole book on Did Jesus Live 100 Years B.C.? It takes a bit of reading. I've been through bits of it. But the idea is accepted by H.P.B., Annie Besant, and many others. And in many ways, the times and his story fit in better with the biblical story than that of the Jesus that we know about. At that time, there was a massacre of the innocents by Herod, and Herod didn't live in Jesus' time, he was dead by then. Ben Parakia, who was a very famous and well-known Jewish rabbi, took the young Ben-Joshua, because Joshua is the same as Jesus. Jesus, the Greek word of Joshua or Jeshai, they're all the same. He took him into Egypt when he was very young. And he was trained there in the mystery schools. And he came back a healer and a worker of miracles. He is supposed to have been, by the way, that's part of the story, the son of a Roman soldier and Miriam, a prostitute. But I don't know. The stories vary a bit. But he came back, and when he started working his miracles, the folk got upset, scared of him, and it is said he was stoned to death or he was hung on a tree. Now, the Romans did the execution on the cross. The Jews didn't. The Jews stoned their people to death. So that's why the Romans actually put Jesus on the cross, not the Jews. They would have stoned him to death. I think I'm right, you can argue. He could have been the teacher of righteousness. He most certainly was close to the Essenes, who existed long before that, hundreds of years before. He could have been the teacher of righteousness that is spoken about in the Dead Sea Scroll. Now the second one is there, up there, Jeshai, again meaning Jesus, Beth Halamichi, or Halachmi. He was the fanatical preacher that CWL talked about. Other people described him slightly differently. But he was a militant, and he was a preacher. And when Pontius Pilate was down at Caesarea, he led a revolt, and he was caught and crucified about AD 30. The other is Apollonius of Tyana, a most marvelous character. Some theosophers suggest that if Pandira was the original Christ, then Apollonius of Tyana was a reincarnation of Jesus. He certainly was a saint. He would have been a master of the wisdom. And his historic figure, a man called Philostratus, wrote down his whole story from a diary kept by his servant Damas. And it traces his travels all over the world. He laid talismans, highly magnetized stones, one of them at Krakow. He went to India and across the Himalayas to meet the masters. He may have traveled much further. 17 temples were erected to him. He was born 4 BC. I should have said that. Born 4 BC. So he lived in that period. He defied the Roman emperors, went to Rome several times, and Nero put him in prison. He escaped from prison by supernatural means. And while he was in Egypt, he saw a vision of the burning of Rome as it was going on under Nero. He is known to have gone and into the Essene communities and revitalized them. So it's possible that incidents in the story of his life were incorporated into the Gospels. G.R.S. Meade says, "It's a fact that most careful research cannot discover a scrap of external evidence in the first century A.D. that witnessed the existence of Jesus. Most modern scholars agree with him, although the Christian book that I read said that Josephus did." That's the man that's here I'll talk about in a moment. Plutarch, living 40 to 120 AD, makes no mention of him. Philo-Judaeus, to whom Geoffrey Hodgson's books are dedicated, he lived from 30 BC to 45 AD, but covered the period of the crucifixion, and none of the other Platonists mention him. I'm not quite sure that's completely true, but one of the books said that was right. Now, Josephus was an amazing character. He wrote his Antiquities of the Jews, as they're called, in 90 AD. Now, he only mentions Jesus. He was a general, and he was in touch with all the the Essene communities. He's written about the Essene communities. He wrote a lot about John the Baptist and his head being brought in on a platter. It's all in his Antiquities. And he was in Masada. You know, after the revolution in 66 AD, when the Jews were pushed to Masada, which is a fortress past the Dead Sea, and they held out for 2 years against the Romans there, and then the Romans built a huge ramp, and all their machines went up the ramp. That was on TV a while ago. And when they got there, all the Jews had committed suicide. Hundreds of them. Now Josephus was there, but he got out, he escaped, to live and fight another battle. And that's in The Source by Michener. That's a magnificent book to read. Anyway, he mentions Jesus in one short paragraph in this book. Now this paragraph up here talks about a great number were slain by this means, and other ran away wounded. And thus an end was put to this sedition. Down here it starts. About the same time, another sad calamity put the Jews in disorder, and certain shameful practices happened about the temple of Isis that was at Rome. In between is squeezed this about Jesus. Now there was about this time Jesus a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a preacher of such men to receive the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many Jews and many Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men among us, why does he say the principal men among us? And he goes on, they forsake him and so on. He did marvelous things. And at the bottom of that, there's a footnote which gives the dates. A.D. 33, April the 3rd, and another footnote, April the 5th. Now, the fixing of the date of the birth of Jesus was fixed 600 A.D. by people who knew all about it. You work it out. It's amazing. So this is usually considered to be spurious. It was added at a later date. I don't know. But there was one Roman, Tacitus, who talked about Jesus, but he got that from, he could have got that from Paul. I don't know, you see, it's all rather hazy. But at least in the next century, he did write about him. Now there's growing evidence that Jesus was an Essene. And they existed for less 2200 years B.C. And they were an esoteric Jewish group, teaching the ancient wisdom as we know it from Greek, Egyptian mystery schools, and some of the Eastern philosophy from Buddhists and Hindus built into it. Many of the Dead Sea Scrolls were pre-Christian, and yet they contained much that is found in the Gospel. So it looks as though those teachings existed and then got built into the Gospel, which is what you would expect. Now, the Essenes are now recognized to have been much more widely spread. They weren't only, the Christian writers say, they were insignificant sect living in the desert. But actually, it's now found that they were in the cities, like Jerusalem, there were groups of them in all the cities. There were certainly in Alexandria, the Therapeutes, and there were Essenes living at Mount Carmel. They were a very powerful group, but they kept to themselves. They were an esoteric group, and there were thousands of them. Now, there's evidence that some of them were militants or zealots. They were fighting against the Romans for hundreds of years, and are there. They were the militant ones who were fighting, and they now have found that there was a forge attached to the community at Qumran, of the Essene community. And they weren't just monks, they were active. They were active against the Jews, and active to keep their esoteric Judaism before the people. Now it's recognized that many of the biblical names refer to one group we've called the Nazareans. The town of Nazareth, I went through it, is only very small, and they say it doesn't exist at that time. So they were later called all sorts of names. The Nazareans and the Essenes are basically the same. Also these other ones are Benites or something, I don't know how to pronounce it, and Zadokites, they were the Qumran Essenes. So you see, Nazareans is the best way to describe the early Christians. Some people call them Judaic Christians, but it's not a very good term. They were Nazareans. Nazarene means the same. It means that those set apart, those who are different, those who are understanding. The Gnostics means those who know from personal experience. And the same would apply to the Nazareans. Now, at that time in Alexandria, which was the center of culture in the Western world, and the Neoplatonists studied all the religions, this is where theosophy started, and had access to the esoteric teachings of Egypt, Greece, Jewish Essenes, Roman, Buddhist, Persian, and many of them became Christians. They became the Christian fathers. And theirs, of course, was the pre-Roman Christianity of the Nazareans. Clement of Alexandria is the best known. He tried to fuse Greek mystery school teaching with Christianity. And plenty of his writings are still available. Then there was Ammonius Sarkis, who was the first to use the word Theosophia. Plotinus, or Plotinus, was the father of Christian mysticism and had several experiences of oneness, cosmic consciousness himself, that he writes about. And then there is the other one. Oh, I've missed one somewhere. Or Origen. Origen was the Egyptian, born of Christian parents, and his book, De Principis, exists. And he clearly stated his belief in reincarnation, which we'll come to in a moment. So now, just to close, let's have a very quick look at how the Romans closed in on all of this. Up till 300 AD, the Christians were persecuted in Rome. So it dates from then on. In 303, Diocletian destroyed all Christian writings. But in 312, the Emperor Constantine had a vision of in hoc signo in the sky, and he decided to fuse the Mithraic teachings of Rome with the Christian teachings of the heretics, as they had been up to then. He did it to get power, I think, or to get a sense of unity in the country. It's most peculiar, this happening. Now, what he actually saw wasn't the Christian cross. It was the cross of Sol Invictus, which is the cross of the Mithraic cross, which comes from the teaching of Zoroaster. Now, not many Christian people would admit that. And writers who have studied it say that Constantine didn't accept Christianity until his deathbed. But he did give the Christians a certain degree of freedom. Illogically, but it happened. In 325, he called the Council of Nicaea, which by making the various Christian sects confront one another, he really pushed them out. He made Rome the official center of Christian orthodoxy. 30 years after stopping and not ceasing to call them heretics, he made Rome the center of Christianity. Now, he made Jesus a god because the emperor was a god. And a distortion there that the Nazareans would not have accepted. He opened the way for the fusion of the church and politics, which later emperors and popes used to very great advantage. There's so much marvelous teaching in the Bible and Christianity. It's very sad that dogma has crept in during the centuries. And there's great danger today because of fundamentalism, which accepts every word as the word, dictated word of God, which you know, but I've said you're not really possible. But we should remember that the true teaching of the Gnostics and the Nazarenes was that the spiritual life requires individual effort to know and to experience the Christ within and live according to that highest that is within us. That was the teaching of the Bible. See what happened to it.
Here we go.